So in this session, we're going to look at the emotional balance. And we briefly mentioned that earlier was that we have emotional imbalance now. And that's coming really from all of these three things, from having unhealthy aspirations and desires, not having a calm, clear, focused mind, and then not seeing things objectively clearly, are leading to a lot of emotional imbalances. And a lot of those emotional imbalances are these, of course, mental afflictions. And within Buddhist psychology, we can talk about many different types of mental imbalance, emotional imbalance. But I think I briefly mentioned earlier, we can talk about what's called the three poisons, the three core mental afflictions. Talk about, and they're called poisons because they're poisoning our mind. And the fundamental mental affliction or klesha in Sanskrit is this ignorance or avidya in Sanskrit. And of course, in general, ignorance is a mind that is really confused about its object, not understanding its object clearly. But here in the three poisons, we're talking about a very specific type of ignorance. We're talking about the ignorance which misunderstands the nature of reality. You know, when we earlier talked about this cognitive balance, to see things clearly objectively, we talked primarily about these two ideas of impermanence and interdependency. Here in the three poisons, the ignorance is really pointing to the second of those, is not understanding the idea of interdependency. Again, intellectually, we may all appreciate that things are interconnected and interdependent, but experientially, that's not really how we are seeing the world. Experientially, we are really seeing instinctively, there's a me here, and there is an objective world out there, independent of me. That's how we are seeing things. And so from a Buddhist perspective, this is a mistaken view. This is not, no cognitive balance here. We are misapprehending nature of reality. We are grasping onto that there is an independent me and an independent objective world out there. And this is the root of all of the other mental afflictions, because it's from this fundamental grasping, there's a me here and a world there, then on that basis, when we have pleasant and unpleasant experiences, it seems like that pleasant experience is the source of my happiness. So I want that thing. So therefore, with pleasant experiences, we develop a lot of attachment. And when we have unpleasant experiences, it seems like that unpleasant person or thing, that's the source of my suffering. So then we automatically have aversion to that experience. So from this fundamental mistaken belief that there is this sort of subject-object duality, this independent me, independent world, we end up with a lot of attachments and aversion based on our pleasant, unpleasant experiences. And then all of the other mental afflictions like jealousy and fear, anxiety and that come out of one of these or a combination of them. So what I'd like to do this afternoon is have a look at this, and we're going to have a look at the aversion tomorrow. In particular,
particular, we're going to have a look at a specific type of aversion called anger.
Because this is very destructive, very harmful.
And, of course, attachment is something that is pervasive in our life.
This is our really our fundamental driving force in our life, is this attachment, craving, desire. This is what's really driving us from moment to moment in our life.
So, therefore, it's important to understand what these are, how they really harm us, and how to deal with them. So as part of then cultivating emotional balance, that's what we're going to do. We're going to have a look at both of these, understand them, and then how we can work with them to reduce them, to try and eliminate them.
So I'd like to start with this afternoon then, attachment.
Those of you actually who are familiar with the life story of the Buddha,
part of that life story is symbolizing these three poisons. And that is when Prince Siddhartha was escaped from the palace, he was out in his search for the meaning of life and how to overcome suffering. He had a number of teachers, but they were not really leading him in the right direction, so he eventually abandoned them and set out on his own. And he sat down to meditate under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya to try to come to the solution, the answer. And the story goes that he was confronted by Mara, the demon Mara, who thought that Prince Siddhartha had some ability to disturb his whole domain here. So in the story it said that he sent five of his most beautiful daughters, to seduce the meditating prince. But as the daughters came closer to him, they withered and aged and they began to stink and grew warts, and so it didn't work and he didn't stir. Then the Mara was really upset that they couldn't seduce the prince, so he sent his army to destroy Prince Siddhartha. So the army fired all these spears and arrows at the prince, and sometimes in the pictures of this you can see these spears and arrows turning into flowers, and so they couldn't manage to harm the prince. So then in the end the Mara himself went to the meditating prince and tried to convince him that he didn't know what he was doing, but then Prince Siddhartha said, you know, I don't need validation, the earth is my witness, and that's when he touched the earth. So sometimes you see the Prince Siddhartha or the Buddha with his right hand touching the earth, and he said, the earth is my witness, and with that Mara disappeared. And so of course the symbolism in that story is the daughters were symbolizing attachment. So Prince Siddhartha was overcoming the inner demon of his attachment. The army was symbolizing anger. So Prince Siddhartha overcame his anger. And then Mara himself is symbolizing ignorance. So eventually he overcame all ignorance and achieved enlightenment. So that's how the symbolized in that story. Also, maybe some of you are familiar. In Buddhism there's a nice drawing called the Wheel of Life, or in Sanskrit the Bhava Chakra, which describes the whole cycle of existence and so forth. And in this very elaborate diagram, right in the middle of the diagram is an inner circle with three animals in the middle. There's a pig, a rooster and a snake. And the pig is symbolizing ignorance, the rooster is attachment, and aversion or anger is dismay. And in that diagram, you often see that the pig is grabbing the tail of the rooster and the snake. Meaning out of the mouth of ignorance comes attachment and aversion. So this is very nicely done in that diagram. So let's now have a look at attachment. Because there's a lot of confusion about this word, so I'd like to try and clear that up. First, how to define the word attachment. Within Buddhism, attachment is defined as a mental factor that sees its object as attractive. So it's a mental factor that sees its object as attractive. It exaggerates the object's attractiveness. So again, it's a mental factor that sees its object as attractive. It exaggerates the object's attractiveness and then wishes to possess and hold the object. So again, mental factor that sees its object as attractive. It exaggerates the object's attractiveness and wishes to possess and hold the object. Why? Because attachment believes that object is the source of our happiness. Now, this is one of the core mental afflictions, and therefore we are to eliminate it fully, 100%. But then, when that's said, sometimes people go, hang on, I don't think I want to become a Buddhist. Because if I give up attachment, I'm not going to enjoy anything in life. Life is going to become very bland and boring. Actually, it's completely opposite. Because it's our attachment that interferes with our enjoyment of the simple pleasures in life. Because we know from our own experience, if we have strong craving or attachment for something, and we don't get it, we get frustrated. Even if we get it, we're worried about not having enough of it or losing it. So we're often very agitated and anxious, you know, I'm going to lose it, I'm going to lose it. So we don't even enjoy it. And if it's, for example, something like chocolate cake, then often what happens if we have strong craving and attachment, we eat it very quickly, we eat too much and we get sick and we don't even enjoy it. So actually attachment destroys our pleasure of things. Also, of course, is attachment is always looking for something bigger, better, different. Bigger, better, different. Which means things that we enjoy now, if we keep getting them, eventually attachment goes, boring, boring, give me something different, give me something different. So actually we even end up not enjoying things that we used to enjoy because attachment says that's no good anymore. And I have a very nice example to highlight this very point. Some years ago, when I did my first long retreat, solitary retreat, I was in a place in Spain, the retreat centre, and they used to bring meals every day to my cabin. I didn't like to cook for myself. And the meals were quite nutritious, but, you know, same menu every week. Now, generally, if we eat the same food every week, after some weeks, even if we like it at the beginning, we'll go, oh, no, not that again. You know, ugh, I've had enough of that. My experience was the opposite. The food was quite nutritious. It was okay. But then after some weeks, I noticed the food was tasting better. And I'm thinking, what's going on here? I'm thinking, wow, the cook's really adding some more herbs and spices, taking more care, because it's really getting better, better. And then after some more weeks, I thought, no, this is exactly the same food I had at the beginning. And I thought, what's going on? And then I realized that what was happening, of course, is as my mind was settling down, my craving and attachment was settling down. Which meant, actually, after some weeks, I was actually tasting the food more clearly, better. I was enjoying it more, not because the food was better, but because my attachment was decreasing. Also, what I found was, I was in a very nice place, I had a very nice view, a very open, spacious view to my cabin. But again, if we're in a very nice place, day after day after day after day after day, after some weeks we go, well, we just think, oh, that's boring now, we don't appreciate it. Exactly the opposite happened with me, is even little things were becoming more beautiful. Just little flowers, a little blade of grass was just, wow, that's amazing, because my attachment was reducing. So my experience, my direct experience was that as my attachment decreased, I was actually appreciating and enjoying things much, much more. Because attachment's always saying, I want something bigger, better and different. Bigger, better, different. Never satisfied. So actually attachment destroys our pleasure of things. So if we reduce our attachment, our enjoyment of the simple pleasures in life will increase. We'll enjoy many more things than we do now. But then sometimes people go, okay, I can maybe sort of understand that. Maybe, yeah, okay, maybe. But definitely I need attachment to have a relationship. Because without attachment, I can't have a relationship. Again, completely the opposite. Completely the opposite. And I think one of the difficulties here comes from the word attachment. And that same word in psychology is used in quite a different way. In fact, generally in psychology, there are forms of attachment which we need to cultivate. We need healthy attachment, like the strong bond between mother and child. You know, I think it's adult attachment theory. And we need that. And in psychology, this is called attachment. So, of course, in psychology there are pathological forms of attachment we need to eliminate, but there are healthy forms we need to actively cultivate. But here, of course, we're talking about something different than what we're talking about here. Because there the word attachment is talking about this strong bond. Of course, in Buddhism we need to have a strong bond, not only mother with child, but we need to have a strong bond connection with everybody. So no problem there at all. So, in fact, I've got a couple of definitions of the word attachment in psychology. One is that attachment is an enduring emotional tie to a special person, characterized by a tendency to seek and maintain closeness, especially during times of stress. Another definition of attachment in psychology is attachment is a feeling that binds one to a person, thing, cause, or the like. Another definition is a feeling of affection for a person. And some synonyms for the word attachment in psychology is affection, devotion, regard, loyalty, love. So what we can see is that word attachment in psychology is not describing the same thing as within Buddhism. So that's one of the obstacles here in terms of attachment. So remember, attachment in Buddhism is a mental factor that sees its object as attractive, it exaggerates the object's attractiveness, and then wishes to possess and hold the object. So what we find, of course, is that in a relationship, attachment is seeing that person as an object to satisfy me. Whereas loving kindness Maitri, the Pali word is metta. And these two words are better translated, I think, as loving kindness rather than love. Because love, in our English language, of course, is definitely an emotion, and usually it implies some sort of intimate behaviour. Maitri or metta is not an emotion, and it does not imply intimate behaviour. Maitri and metta is an aspiration. It's an aspiration, it's a wish for ourselves and others to be happy. So therefore it's better translated as loving kindness than love. So loving kindness in general, of course, is the wish for ourselves and others to be happy. So, therefore, there's a big difference between love or loving kindness and attachment. So, loving kindness, of course, in a relationship is simply the wish for that person to be happy. And the fine print, of course, is without expecting anything in return. What we would call unconditional love. No strings attached love. Strings attached love or conditional love is love polluted by attachment. And that sounds like this. It's, I will love you as long as, it comes a condition, I will love you as long as you keep saying and doing things that make me happy. I'll love you that long. So that's love polluted by attachment. So, very simply, the difference between love or loving kindness and attachment, love or loving kindness is simply saying, I want you to be happy. Attachment is saying, I want you to make me happy. So attachment is all about me, 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 me. And it really sees the other person as an object to satisfy me. It does not even consider the other person as a person. So therefore, what we need to understand is in that all relationships, there are two dynamics going on. There is the genuine love or loving kindness, and then usually mixed in with that is attachment. And often, to us, it seems like there's only one thing. And that if we get rid of attachment, out goes the love with it. So what we need to understand is that there are two dynamics operating. We need to distinguish them, and we need to increase the loving kindness and decrease the attachment as much as possible if we want our relationships to improve. Now, often we hear about this idea that we need to love everyone equally. What, of course, that means from a Buddhist perspective is it does not mean we need to spend equal amount of time and behave equally with everyone. That is a disaster if we try to do that. When we talk about loving everyone equally, we're talking about equally developing the aspiration of wishing everyone equally to be happy. So that we can aspire to. We can aspire to equally have that aspiration towards everyone. To wish ourselves and everyone else to be happy, to have happiness in accord. That we can aspire to. So, with that equal attitude of loving kindness, we would express that attitude very differently depending on the person. To our partner, we would express that loving kindness in a very intimate way and spend a lot of time with them. To our family members, we would express that same loving kindness in a very different way. And to our work colleagues and neighbours, we would express that same loving kindness in a very different way and maybe not spend hardly any time with them. But we can have the equal attitude towards everyone. Any questions about loving kindness versus attachment? Because usually this is a very sticky point. I can't hear you, sorry. Something about... Yeah. You're looking for a different word than attachment? Right.
I mean, here, of course, I think in a relationship, we can use the word clinging. Clinging is a good word, I think. Huh? We're clinging. We want to hold on to it because they are the source of my happiness. So, in terms of objects, attachment can be just simply craving. Another word that is very vague is the word desire.
And the word desire is often used in a lot of Buddhist texts. Sometimes the word desire is another word for attachment. So sometimes you'll see in Buddhist texts, get rid of all desire. But then sometimes in Buddhist texts, it says there are particular desires we need to cultivate. But then that word desire does not mean attachment. It means aspiration. So, you know, we can aspire to develop positive qualities. We can aspire to reduce our negative qualities. That sort of desire in terms of aspiration we need to increase. But desire in terms of craving or attachment we need to decrease. I mean, if we have craving and attachment for enlightenment or nirvana or whatever, that's an obstacle. You know? So, therefore, we need to be very careful with words. Like another word is passion. You know? Because sometimes when we say we've got to get rid of attachment, people think, oh, I won't have any passion for life. Life will be very passionless. You know, I'll be like a zombie. But again, passion can be, in a positive sense, passion can be healthy aspirations. Yes, we need to have a passion to improve ourselves and eliminate negativity in our mind and help others. These sorts of passion we need to increase. But passion, in terms of craving and desiring and clinging, that we need to get rid of. So again, we need to be very careful when we use these words, attachment, desire, passion, and so forth. Some of them can have both a positive understanding or a negative. So here when we're talking about attachment, we're always talking about that sort of what craving, that clinging. What do you mean by then clinging on to that person?
Yes, there's something about it which holds you back to go away from that. It can be an object, it can be a person.
Well, maybe it's then that you're not aware of what it is you're having attachment to. So we can have attachment to something without being overtly aware of why we're clinging to it. That is certainly possible. So maybe intellectually we examine and it doesn't seem attractive and I don't seem to be exaggerating, yet I'm clinging. But that's just because we don't really understand the subtler workings of our mind. What you will find is with things like this, the attentional balance, the training in mindfulness, is part of that is these things will become much more obvious. I mean, often in our behaviour, when we have some sort of dysfunctional behaviour, it's not obvious to us, but everyone around us, it's clear as day what we're doing wrong, but we can't see it because we don't have this. So what you'll find is that once you start to do this attentional training, mindfulness training, our mental habit patterns become more and more and more clear to us. And the more clear to us they become, and the more that we see that certain habit patterns are completely dysfunctional, the more difficult it is for us to continue to do them, because we see that is just completely dysfunctional. That's not bringing me anything. So you'll find that just doing this often helps to clear up a lot of these things. At least identify why we're doing it. Yeah, so again, it all comes back to this. It all comes back to this, and that's right. And this is going to come in a little bit later, I think that tomorrow we're going to talk about this selfish motivation, you know, this me. Yeah, and it's really coming down
to this ignorant view here is that, you know, if we see this, or there's a poor little me here in a big bad world out there, then of course we're going to develop a lot of fear and anxiety about the world, and therefore, you know, we won't be able to feel this. This is like a big hole here. We need to fill it. And so we do all this, try and fill this hole. But the whole problem is this. The whole problem is believing that there's this poor little me here that needs all this stuff. And so if we can shift that, then we can, and we can develop that to others, then we're nourished. We can only get nourished by nourishing. I think those two things are saying the same thing from different perspectives. Because if you're happy that someone's happy, and they're not happy, then you're unhappy. So I think you can't really separate them. I mean, there's two aspects of the same thing. We can address them individually, as we do with loving kindness and compassion. But actually, they're like two sides of the coin. Yeah. Well, by focusing on the happiness and the suffering separately and developing those, but you'll find that actually they converge, you know, that they're actually one thing. But as a beginner, it's good to focus on this from these multiple perspectives to really move forward. Well, loving kindness is focusing on happiness, and compassion is focusing on suffering. So, loving kindness, right, your metta, is the wish for ourselves and others to be happy. Compassion, or karuna, is the wish for ourselves and others to be free of suffering. Of course, they go together. We can't be happy without free of suffering. But we can focus on them from those two perspectives, and that can be very helpful to focus on both of those individually, but of course, at the higher level, they're the same thing, really. Yeah. Right. Right. Ethics is really based on this, well, and this, but primarily here. I mean, if we can really see things as interdependent, we would be completely ethical. It wouldn't even cross our mind to be unethical, because harming someone else is harming ourselves. So, at the deepest level, that's why in those three trainings, you know, we have the wisdom, is that ethics, really, at the deepest level, is coming from this. The understanding that everything is interdependent, interconnected. That's what's going to be driving our ethical behaviour, at the deepest level. Is that the question? Right. Of course, how they... Sure, of course.
So leads to what, sorry?
Right. If we have this fully, it's impossible to have this. Impossible. Like the example would be, you know, say we're dreaming and we see something attractive in the dream. In the dream, we believe there's a dream me and an independent dream world. So, of course, in the dream, if we see something attractive, we have attraction craving. But if we become lucid in the dream, if in the middle of the dream we suddenly realize this is a dream, then there still will be a dream me, and there still will appear to be an independent dream world there. But because we're lucid now, experientially, we know that this appearance is deceiving us, which means we still see an attractive object or person in the dream. But what's there to grab? What's there to have attachment to? Because this is a product of our mind. Which means, if we're lucid in the dream, it would become impossible to have attachment, and we would enjoy that pleasurable experience much more. That's what happens in waking world if we develop cognitive balance. If we become lucid in our waking world by realizing that everything's interdependent, then it becomes actually impossible to have attachment to things or people, like the lucid dream example. And we would enjoy that pleasant experience much more than we do now. That's the implication of cognitive. And of course the other implication is not only attachment, it would become almost impossible to actually do any harm to anyone with anger for the same reason.
Everything is unclear.
Everything's changing, and within that changing world, now we're getting a little bit into a lot of depth here. I'll try and give a simple answer. Is that of course there are things are changing, but within that changing world we develop concepts to help us to make meaning or sense of this world. You know, there's just a flow of change in front of us, and so we've developed a concept of bowl to help us understand what's in front of us. So these concepts are useful and they describe things accurately as long as we understand these concepts are describing something that is in a state of flow and change. So there's no contradiction or paradox in having these concepts to map onto a changing world, as long as we understand that. Otherwise, then we can get problems. Okay, one more thing, and then we'll do a short meditation. And so when then people can say, okay, I can sort of understand that there may be in relationships there are these two dynamics. There is this love or loving kindness and attachment, and I need to sort of distinguish them and increase the loving kindness and try to decrease the attachment. If I do that, relationships will improve. But then still people say, but I'm a creative person. And I think this maybe applies to a lot of people here. And I need attachment to be creative. Completely wrong. Of course, mental afflictions like craving, attachment, anger, jealousy provides a lot of fuel for creativity. How much songs and music and art are being created from mental afflictions? Enormous. But are mental afflictions the source of creativity or not? No. As long as our mind is disturbed by craving, attachment and anger, our creativity is being suffocated. Creativity best comes through when our mind is still and quiet. Because creativity comes from a deeper level of our mind. As long as the mind is being disturbed by mental afflictions, creativity doesn't work. If we can really develop attentional balance, if we can quiet the mind, if we can reduce these mental afflictions, creativity will come through more frequently. This is very common, and maybe some of you may experience this in the coming days. When you do a retreat and your mind starts to settle down, particularly if you're a little bit creative, all of a sudden, all these fantastic ideas will start popping up. You know, things that you've tried to work out for the last month, all of a sudden there's an answer, or there's a fantastic idea of something you're going to do at work. It'll just pop out of nowhere. And this is creativity, because it's coming from a deeper level of the mind when the mind is very still. So again, all of you creative people, this attentional balance is very good for creativity. Very good for creativity. Also, of course, now often people are creative for quite selfish motivations. You know, look at me, how wonderful an artist or musician I am. Whereas I think the truly, truly great creative people on the planet are the ones who use their creative talents to inspire others for a good purpose. So if we not only develop this attentional balance, but we have motivational, emotional balance, and we develop these positive qualities, what you will find is not only will you be more creative, but your creativity will be for a more rewarding reason. You'll be using your creative talents to inspire others for a good purpose in the world. So by engaging in these sorts of practices, then we will become more creative and will be more rewarding or fulfilling motivation for being creative, to use our creative talents to inspire others in the world. And this is often my experience in retreat as well. You know, once you start to do a bit of retreat, really, you're just doing some focusing on the breath, and all of a sudden, all these fantastic ideas just come out of nowhere. So much so that sometimes in retreat recommendation, of course, if we start to then get caught up in these wonderful ideas in the meditation, then that's an obstacle because we're getting distracted. But then what we can do, and this will happen to you at some stages, is if you're doing some sort of mindfulness training and some great idea pops up, then simply go, okay, fantastic idea, I'll look at that after the meditation. If you're worried about forgetting it, have a little notepad, just jot down a few key words and then go back to the practice. And then look at that creative idea outside of meditation. Otherwise, you'll find that you're constantly going to have all these great ideas come up and your mindfulness practice won't get very far because you'll get distracted by and caught up in them. So that's just a little side point. So the bottom line is, if we reduce our attachment, we will enjoy the simple pleasures in life more, our relationships will improve, we'll become more creative for a more meaningful reason. Win-win-win situation. So don't worry about getting rid of attachment. Our last question, otherwise we'll do short meditation on attachment, dealing with attachment. Any last question about attachment? Yeah. Right. So here again, we have to be careful with the word. I think this came up earlier, this idea of detachment or unattachment. Yeah. So we can use the word unattached or detached, but that, I personally, I really don't like the word detached, because as soon as I hear the word detached, it seems like, oh, I have to separate from them. We're not talking about that. So better is to say non-attachment. Non-attachment means that we are getting rid of the pollution in our loving kindness. So what's left is a strong connection to that person. If we get non-attachment, if we get rid of attachment, we have a very healthy connection to that person where we are really caring for that person and wishing them to be happy. Whether or not we're in a relationship or they're a family member, work colleague, neighbour, someone we don't really know. That's going to be the result of non-attachment, is that we simply are getting rid of the pollution in that healthy connection of loving kindness or wishing that person to be happy. Of course, it's better initially to be attached to knowledge than drugs and alcohol, yes. But that attachment to knowledge is going to block us. So we can have aspirations for knowledge, and if we notice there's craving and attachment, try to reduce that. Because otherwise, we're going to get frustrated, disappointed, all of these things, and it can, right, but from the very beginning, if we can notice the attachment and even from the very beginning try to reduce it, it'll help us even more. So yes, it's true that craving and attachment for some worthwhile thing mixed in with healthy aspiration can kickstart something, but even at the beginning level, if we can really identify the attachment and try to reduce that and increase the aspiration for knowledge, the aspiration, that will make us even go quicker. Okay, let's do a short meditation. We're going to have a little bit of a look at how some ways of dealing with attachment. So again, about 15-minute meditation, and then we'll have another tea break. So again, then finding a nice and comfortable posture. So again, it's an act of loving kindness for yourself. Allow your awareness to descend into your body. Becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. If you find it helpful, you can take 3 slow, deep breaths, maintaining awareness of sensations throughout the body as you breathe. allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Setting the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. Letting go of any thoughts of the past or the future. And simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. So let's now have a look at some ways of dealing with attachment. So remember, attachment is defined as a mental factor that sees its object as attractive. It exaggerates the object's attractiveness and then wishes to possess and hold the object. So let's now look at some ways of dealing with attachment. So first bring to mind a person or thing that you have some strong attachment to. A person or thing that seems to be crucial to your happiness. And then imagine that you actually have your object of attachment and that you're holding on tightly, not wanting to lose that person or thing. And picture the scene very clearly. How does your attachment make you feel? Is your mind relaxed and calm? Does that person or thing have the power to bring you lasting happiness that you seek? Now, if you mentally relax your grip on the person or thing you're attached to, allowing it to just be, allowing some space, how do you feel? Is your mind more calm and relaxed? And without the clinging, are you more able to enjoy the presence of that person or thing? Now recall that the person or thing you're attached to is impermanent, changing from moment to moment. In a constant state of change, not remaining the same from one moment to the next. Constantly changing. Through seeing this, check whether your attachment to that personal thing remains the same. Now imagine that personal thing you're attached to changing over time and becoming very old. And again, check whether your attachment to that personal thing remains the same. And again, imagine the person or thing you're attached to clearly in front of you. what is it exactly that makes that person or thing so attractive, so desirable? So mentally dissect the person or thing into its parts and try to pinpoint what exactly is so attractive, so desirable. Now try to think of someone who may not see your object of attachment as attractive or desirable. Is their perception invalid? Are you seeing that personal thing in the correct way while they are mistaken? Or is it that due to your own experience, you are correctly labeling that personal thing as attractive, and that due to this other person having a completely different experience, they are correctly labeling that personal thing in a completely different way? And that due to your labeling of that personal thing as attractive, are you then going on to seeing that personal thing as inherently attractive? And as a result, do you develop some attachment, thinking that that personal thing is the source of your happiness? Nothing is inherently one way or another. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And by understanding this, then whether it is a relationship with another person or simply eating a piece of chocolate cake, we won't cling to that experience. And as a result, we will enjoy that experience more fully. So in conclusion, recognize that it is possible to practice these methods of letting go of attachment, and that when we do, we will feel more balanced and free to enjoy things without clinging. more balanced and free to enjoy and improve our relationships with others. And make a strong determination to do so. Any questions about that meditation before we go for a break? Okay, let's take another break. So we've got a little bit over 20 minutes, and so we'll come back at 5 o'clock. And then we'll go back to the mindfulness training.